I was in Iraq, I didn't want somebody sending my ass 6-week-old stale brownies or a 5-minute calling card. You can't even get a dial tone in Iraq with a 5-minute calling card. I wanted them to get me and my friends' asses out of there and for none of us to die for no reason.
During the 2004 election, the war wasn't really much of a factor. Yeah, the Bush administration had the Department of Homeland Security raise the terror threat levels whenever John Kerry would do better, but by and large, it really wasn't that much of a factor. The war began in March of 2003, and within a few months, the Bush administration had declared mission accomplished. Here we are 13 years later, heading into the 14th year of that war, where they declared mission accomplished. In 2008, though, the war was a factor. We'll get to that in a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out. My name is Melvin. Thank you for being here. Episode number 170. Let's get this show started. During the 2008 election, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were both forced to talk about the war. And Barack Obama, Senator Barack Obama at that time, really hammered Hillary Clinton on her vote for the war. The war had waged on for almost 5 years, and everybody was absolutely sick of it. It's in year five, heading into year six, and we were tired of it. Tired of hearing about people coming home and people being maimed and all the money that we were spending, and we weren't making any progress, and then there was the surge and all these other things. It's going to be great. The war's going to be great. And nothing ever got better. And I believe that that war vote was one of the things that cost Hillary Clinton her chance at the White House back in 2008. Because really, who was Barack Obama? She really got hit kind of out of nowhere by this guy. Then in 2012, it wasn't much of a subject because, well, why should it be? Mitt Romney's a Republican. He's going to be great with the war. And at that point, Barack Obama had been overseeing that war for 4 years. Now, it's 2016, and we had a primary this year. And what was narrowly discussed, was the war. It seemed to not really be a factor at all. And why is that? Here's the thing that we need to understand about the two major parties here in America. And today, man, did you pick a good day to be here. Melvin is not going to be making any friends today. Both the Democratic and Republican Party are their own corporations, their own non-profit corporations. Follow me here. Donald Trump is able to say to certain media outlets, you're no longer allowed to cover me. He's done this with the Washington Post and some others. You're no longer allowed to cover me. You're no longer allowed to cover me. The only people that are allowed to cover, that are supposed to be able to cover Donald Trump or show up to his press events are the people that are going to write friendly things about him. Trump does not like a free press. So why is he able to kick them out? One of these two people is going to be president. It's either going to be him or her. Why is he? Because these are private corporations. They are non-profit corporations, but they are private corporations and corporations nonetheless. But even though you are a non-profit, you are still in the money game.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad. The American people will not relish the idea of any American citizen growing rich and fat in an emergency of blood and slaughter and human suffering.
I hate war, and I hated it long before we got into these super-duper long wars that we're in now. And you may ask why we're still in them. When we had a Republican president, we were at war, in a perpetual state of warfare, which, by the way, gives the executive branch a whole lot of power. So if you don't want the government to have a lot of power, you really shouldn't want war. And now we've had a Democratic president for 8 years. Now, I understand the defense. He has been trying to bring a responsible end to it by fighting it in a different way. But the fact remains, the reason why this is still happening, why these wars are still going on, seemingly without end, is for the same reason that we do anything that doesn't make sense in America, because it's profitable. This from 24/7 Wall Street, quoting, "The business of war is profitable. In the year 2011, the 100 largest contractors sold $410 billion in arms and military services. Just 10 of those companies sold over $208 billion. based on a list of the top 100 arms-producing and military services companies in 2011, compiled by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. And the companies are as follows. United Technologies, which does aircraft, electronics, and engines. Arms sales, $11.6 billion. Total sales, $58.2 billion. Gross profit, $5.3. L3 Communications, which makes electronics. Arms sales, $12.5 billion. Total sales, $15.2 billion. These companies make the vast majority of their money on war. And it becomes nearly impossible to end these wars when they're for profit. Fena Mechanica, aircraft, artillery, engines, electronics, vehicles, missiles, arms sales, $14.6 billion. Total sales, $24.4 billion. If you'll notice, more than half the money that they're making is from war. EADS, aircraft, electronics, missiles, and space, $16.4 billion. Total sales, $68.3 billion. That one's a smaller slice of the pie, but it's still no less important. Northrop Grumman, aircraft, electronics, missiles, ships, space. Arms sales, $21.4 billion. Total sales, $26.4 billion. Raytheon, electronics and missiles, $22.5 billion. Money, money, money. General Dynamics, money, money, money. BAE Systems, money, money, money. Boeing and Lockheed Martin, money, 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 all of it in the billions.
But while we guard our shores against threats of war, we will continue to remove the causes of unrest and antagonism at home, which might make our people more easy victims to those for whom foreign war is profitable. And note well that those who stand to profit by war are not on our side in this campaign.
That's two clips from FDR now, because there was a time where American presidents, including Democratic ones who ran for president, ran against the war. Now, when it comes to Republicans, they are always going to run for the war because, once again, it's very, very profitable and they would like some of that sweet, sweet cash. Please.
Had a lot of wars of my own. I'm really good at war. I love war in a certain way.
We expect that from them, but what we're not supposed to expect it from are the Democrats. And we, as folks who vote for Democrats, we should not be tolerating it. We're supposed to be separate from the other party. Now, when we go to Washington, we're supposed to say that we are going to take the money, which, by the way, more than half of what we spend, more than half of what the federal government spends is spent on arms, is spent on war, is spent in foreign lands. Well, all the while, we're being told, no, we cannot pay for our kids to go to college. No, we cannot pay to house our homeless people. No, we cannot pay to feed the hungry. No, we cannot pay for your health care. No, we cannot. No, 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 no. We cannot pay for roads and bridges. We cannot raise the salaries of our teachers. No, no, no. Why? Because we're broke. We have no money. Seems like it's broken. Seems like the system itself is broken. But it's broken by way of you. Yes, you, the American voter, who has decided that this is either too much to take or too complicated, and you have decided to go ahead and simply not pay attention to what's going on out there. We are not broke. We have the money. You and I pay plenty in taxes. So where the hell does all that money go? You don't like paying taxes, and you really, really, really should be curious where the hell it's going. But we're not. We simply pay them, we bitch about the government, and then we do absolutely nothing about it. We go to the ballot box and we vote for Republicans, we vote for corporate Democrats, and we just say, it's fine, not worried about it. Hey, we can't have nice things, we can't even have things that we need because we're broke. No, we're not broke. And it's true. The government itself does, it seems to be broken. But there is one party who has gone there promising every year that they're going to break it.
You and I love Trump because we know he'll go to Washington and break it.
And then there's another party that has said that they're going to go there and fix it. And they have done the exact opposite. Now, there are a few exceptions. There are good Democrats. Tulsi Gabbard, Bernie Sanders comes to mind. But that's not the majority of Democrats. And that's not any of the Republicans. And it's allowed to be this way because we don't demand the accountability.
Let me be as blunt and as direct as I can be. Western civilization is in a war. We should, frankly, test every person from here who is of a Muslim background, and if they believe in Sharia, they should be deported. Sharia is incompatible with Western civilization. Modern Muslims who have given up Sharia, glad to have them as citizens, perfectly happy to have them next door. But we need to be fairly relentless about defining who our enemies are. Anybody who goes on a website favoring ISIS or Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups, that should be a felony, and they should go to jail. Any organization which hosts such a website should be engaged in a felony. It should be closed down immediately. Our forces should be used to systematically destroy every Internet-based source. And frankly, if we can't destroy them through the Internet, we should destroy them with kinetic power, using various weapons, starting with predators, and just frankly, just killing them.
The scapegoat that we have found here in America is not the companies that profit from war, nor is it the politicians who continue to vote for war and who take money from these companies who make all of their money from war. We've decided to scapegoat Muslims, because the way that we have decided to respond to this is to turn in on each other, is to take a country that is made up of immigrants and look at other immigrants in this country and say they must be the problem. The problem is Al-Qaeda. The problem is ISIS. Yes, of course, but we've noticed that both of those groups have a lot of brown people in them. So what we really need to do in America is we need to go after the brown people, especially the one that wear headscarves. We've set ourselves up for this by creating ISIS. Yes, America intentionally created ISIS. America also intentionally created Al-Qaeda, where this all began. So this from Global Research, the CIA gave birth to Osama bin Laden and breastfed his organization during the 1980s. Former British Sovereign Secretary Robin Cook told the House of Commons that Al-Qaeda was unquestionably a product of Western intelligence agencies. Mr. Cook explained that Al-Qaeda, which literally means an abbreviation of the database in Arabic, was originally the computer database of the thousands of Islamic extremists who were trained by the CIA and funded by the Saudis in order to defeat the Russians in Afghanistan. The 2003 American invasion and occupation of Iraq created the preconditions for radical Sunni groups like ISIS to take root. America rather unwisely destroyed Saddam Hussein's secular state machinery and replaced it with a predominantly Shiite administration. The U.S. occupation caused vast unemployment in Sunni areas. By rejecting socialism and closing down factories in the naive hope that the magical hand of the free market would create jobs under the new U.S.-backed Shiite regime, working-class Sunnis lost hundreds of thousands of jobs. Unlike the white Africaners in South Africa who were allowed to keep their wealth after regime change, upper-class Sunnis were systematically dispossessed of their assets and lost their political influence. Rather than promoting religious integration and unity, American policy in Iraq exacerbated sectarian divisions and created a fertile breeding ground for Sunni discontent, from which Al-Qaeda in Iraq took root. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, used to have a different name, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And by the way, Al-Qaeda in Iraq was not directly connected with Al-Qaeda. They simply called themselves Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and after 2010, they rebranded themselves and refocused their efforts in Syria. America's Middle East policy revolves around oil and Israel. The invasion of Iraq has partially satisfied Washington's thirst for oil, but ongoing airstrikes in Syria and economic sanctions on Iran have everything to do with Israel. The goal is to deprive Israel's neighboring regimes, Lebanon's Hezbollah and Palestine's Hamas, of crucial Syrian and Iranian support. ISIS is not merely an instrument of terror used by America to topple the Syrian government. It is also used to put pressure on Iran. Listen. The last time Iran invaded another nation was 1738. Since independence in 1776, the U.S. has engaged in over 53 military invasions and expeditions. Despite what the U.S. media's war cries would have you believe, Iran is clearly not the threat to regional security. Washington is. An intelligence report published in 2012 endorsed by all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, confirms that Iran ended its nuclear weapons program in 2003. Truth is, any Iranian nuclear ambition, real or imagined, is a result of American hostility towards Iran and not the other way around. America is using ISIS in three ways: to attack its enemies in the Middle East, to serve as a pretext for the U.S. military intervention abroad, and at home to foment a manufactured domestic threat used to justify the unprecedented expansion of invasive domestic surveillance. Terrorism is an excuse to justify mass surveillance in preparation for a mass revolt. The so-called war on terror should have been seen for what it really is, a pretext for maintaining a dangerously oversized U.S. military. The two most powerful groups in the U.S. policy establishment are the Israel lobby, which directs U.S. Middle East policy, and the military-industrial complex, which profits from the former group's actions. Since George W. Bush declared a war on terror in October 2001, it has cost the American taxpayer approximately $6.6 trillion and thousands of fallen sons and daughters. But the wars have also raked in billions for Washington's military elite.
Tonight we are honored to stand here as parents of Captain Humayun Khan and as patriotic American Muslims, as patriotic American Muslims with undivided loyalty to our country. Like many immigrants, we came to this country empty-handed. We believed in American democracy, that with hard work and goodness of this country, we could share in and contribute to its blessings. We are blessed to raise our three sons in a nation where they were free to be themselves and follow their dreams. Our son, Humayun, had dreams too of being a military lawyer, but he put those dreams aside the day he sacrificed his life to save the lives of his fellow soldiers.
When Khizr Khan spoke at the Democratic National Convention, it was a proud moment for most of us. And according to Google Analytics, the number one trending topic while he was live on television, while Khizr Khan, whose son died in the Iraq War, the number one trending topic when he was speaking was how, according to Google Analytics, how do I register to vote? And so his speech had its intended purpose, but it also exposed a dark side, the very dark side of America and our relationship with the Muslim world, which has deteriorated over the last number of years.
Hillary Clinton was right when she called my son the best of America. If it was up to Donald Trump, he never would have been in America. Donald Trump consistently smears the character of Muslims. He disrespects other minorities, women, judges, even his own party leadership. He vows to build walls and ban us from this country. Donald Trump, you're asking Americans to trust you with their future. Let me ask you, have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy.
Donald Trump smears Muslims, much to the glee of American conservatives. Now, at the Democratic Convention, they were cheering for Khizr Khan and cheering for his son, Humayun, who was killed in the war, saving his fellow soldiers. But the Republicans, their nominee, decided to smear this Muslim family, decided to go after a Gold Star family whose Muslim son died in the war, much to the glee, because he's Muslim, of Republican voters. And this is what's happened, this war that we have for profit, not for any other good purpose, not for any noble cause, this war that we have on profit. We have made a punching bag out of Muslims. We have made a target out of Muslims.
Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing and no one.
Do you remember Ahmed Mohammed? He's a 14-year-old Muslim boy. Him and his family were living in America, and he was in high school. And he, learning the stuff he got from school, decided to make a clock, which I thought was a fantastic idea. But he had brown skin and an accent. And when he showed the clock to his teacher, they thought that it was a bomb. He was arrested. He was hauled off. He was questioned. His family was questioned. And then not long after that, his family, the Mohammeds, began getting death threats. Death threats by the hundreds. From people on the internet who watch Fox News, who listen to conservative talk radio, and who decided that these guys must definitely be terrorists because this is what they've been told by the American media. This is what they've been told by the American government, that these people must be terrorists. And so Ahmed Mohammed and his family last October had to move back to Qatar. They had to leave America because they feared for their own safety. The boy didn't do anything. The boy made a clock, period. That's it. And they had to leave America because of the death threats that followed him making a clock in school. That's how frightened we are. So there was an article that came out recently in New York Times by Rukmini Kalamaki, and it's about Harry Sarfo. Now, Harry Sarfo is in jail now. He's a German man who joined the Islamic State. And he joined, but then he eventually escaped, turned himself in, and is now granted this interview to the New York Times. It's a pretty lengthy interview. I'll give you just a little bit of it. Believing he was answering a holy call, Harry Sarfo left his home in the working-class city of Bremen last year, drove for four straight days to reach the territory controlled by the Islamic State in Syria. He barely had time to settle in before members of the Islamic State Secret Service, wearing masks over their faces, came to inform him and his German friend that they no longer wanted Europeans to come to Syria. Where they really needed them was back home to help carry out the group's plan of waging terrorism across the globe. He was speaking openly about the situation, saying that they have loads of people living in European countries waiting for commands to attack the European people. Mr. Sarfo recounted in an interview with the New York Times conducted in English inside the maximum security prison near Bremen, and this was before the Brussels and Paris attacks. So here's what you need to know about ISIS. They have an external operations branch within the Islamic State. The group is called ENMI. Reinforcing the idea that ENMI is a core part of the Islamic State's operations, the interviews and documents indicate that the unit has carte blanche to recruit and reroute operatives from all parts of the organization, from new arrivals to seasoned battlefield fighters, and from the group's special forces and its elite command units. Taken together, the interrogation records show that operatives are selected nationally and grouped by language into small, discrete units whose members sometimes only meet one another on the eve of their departure abroad. So They get these folks. And by the way, they recruit quite a few of them over the internet. We'll get to that in just a minute. Or they go and they meet the Islamic State. And then they learn, they're checked out, they're interviewed, they're checked out by a doctor. They're interviewed, they're radicalized, they're sent home to await instructions. And so Harry Sarfo talks about some of those folks.
And one man approached me and said, I heard you used to live in London and I heard you were born in Germany. Do you have any contacts or any networks in Germany who are willing to give their life for the Amir Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? And I told him, no, I don't have no one. I'm not willing to go back as well. Then he said, especially in Germany and in England, is lacking of people who are willing to give their life. My friend asked them, so what about France? Because when they were asking about England and Germany, that they don't have people who are ready to give their life. And then my friend asked them, what about France? And they start laughing, but really serious laughing with tears in their eyes. And I said, oh, don't worry about France. Mafi mushkila in Arabic means no problem. France is, don't worry about France. France, we have enough people.
So I was reading about how they've got folks awaiting instruction in Austria, Germany, Spain, Lebanon, Tunisia, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Malaysia, all of these countries. And I was looking and I said, the U.S. doesn't really seem to be on this list. Now, we're scared. We're crapping our pants here in America. Not me. I'm not a conservative. Crapping our pants here in America. Oh, my God. ISIL's everywhere. ISIL's coming out of my kitchen sink. ISIL's in my toilet. ISIL's in my pool. ISIL's in my garage. ISIL's everywhere. Here comes ISIL. I need as many guns as possible. But then he spoke about this.
They are Americans. But the guys from Marseille said that for America and Canada, it's much more easier to get them over the social network. And because they say America is that dumb, that because they have open gun policy. This is easy to get radical Muslims to buy guns. They say we can radicalize them easily, and if they don't have no criminal record, they can buy them guns themselves. We don't need to have no contact man who has to provide guns for them.
Americans are dumb, and they, from him here, and he said they're easily radicalized over the internet. But wait a minute, when Trump builds a wall, that won't be happening anymore, but the wall isn't going to keep out the internet. He said Americans are dumb, and they're easy to radicalize, and they're dumb because they've got really loose gun policies, meaning that ISIS doesn't have to have a point man that assigns them a weapon. They can go out and buy one because it's so easy to get a gun in America. And this is why it's easy to carry out a terrorist attack. So we've got dumb foreign policy. Why? Because it makes somebody money. Dumb social policy. Why? Because it makes somebody money. Dumb gun policies. Why? Because it makes somebody money. And all the while, it doesn't matter what's happening. We simply turn it back on the Muslims and say it's all their fault. This is Jason Miller, the communications director for the Trump campaign, sitting down with a CNN anchor. Now, listen to the exchange between these two. It's interesting how the communications director just keeps bringing it back to it's all the Muslims' fault.
He said that, Mr. Trump, while I feel deeply for the loss of his son, Mr. Khan, who has never met me, has no right to stand in front of millions of people and claim that I have never read the Constitution, which is false, and say many other inaccurate things. The First Amendment to the Constitution allows Mr. Khan the right to stand on stage and say whatever he wants. Why would Mr. Trump say he doesn't have that right?
That's not what Mr. Trump is saying at all. What he's saying is that Mr. Trump has a right to defend himself and to make clear what he's saying is this is about radical Islamic terrorism. For him to be criticized like that, he didn't think was fair. So let's get back to the broader point here, the fact that the media
Back on screen. The statement on screen says Mr. Khan has no right to say what he said. You and I, Jason, we both know Mr. Khan has the right to say whatever he wants to say, right?
Brian, Mr. Khan, this is about radical Islamic terrorism, and this is about what's really going on here and the fact that media doesn't want to pick up and cover what's going on with this country. I mean, where was the media outrage following Cleveland when we had supporters and survivors of those who had either been hurt or killed by illegal aliens in this country? There was no media outrage following that. But again, what we're talking about here is radical Islamic terrorism, and that's what's important.
You keep mentioning radical Islamic terrorism as if that's somehow linked to Mr. Khan. Why do you keep responding that way when I mention him?
Because that's the broader debate that we're having. The broader debate that we're having is about the screening and the vetting that we're having for people who are coming into this country.
But that has nothing to do with this family, with this Muslim American family.
This is what the whole broader debate is about right now. This is not about Mr. Trump and Mr. Khan. This is about Mr. Trump and Hillary Clinton.
But Mr. Khan is making it about Mr. Trump, saying he has a black soul, saying that he's ignorant. And you keep bringing up radical Islamic terrorism instead. Are you trying to change the subject, or are you trying to link him to terrorism?
No, not at all, Brian. That's not what I'm saying. Don't try to put words in my mouth. What I'm saying is that this is the broader issue that we're debating. Mr. Trump's opponent is Hillary Clinton, and that's who we're running against here.
This from Thomas Peters over at Reuters. The United States has insisted that the Iraq military act as a conduit for any new aid and arrangements and armaments being supplied for counteroffensive, including money and weapons intended for tribal fighters willing to push out the Islamic State. In its 2015 budget, the Pentagon has requested $1.3 billion to provide weapons for the government forces and $24.1 billion intended for the tribes. But some of the weaponry recently supplied by the Army has already ended up on the black market and in the hands of Islamic State fighters, according to Iraqi officers and lawmakers. During a decade of war in Iraq, the U.S. government gained a lot of institutional knowledge about the country and its army. America's intelligence gathering there was comparatively sophisticated. Lots of American diplomats gained expertise on the ground, and U.S. forces trained, advised, and fought beside many of the men in the army. Despite all of this, the United States has been unable to funnel weapons through Iraq without ISIS getting them. So, in Syria, where the U.S. has inferior knowledge and intelligence gathering, was it ever plausible for Washington to identify and arm moderate rebels without a much greater risk of ISIS getting a hold of the weapons? So here is what we're doing. We are ensuring that these fights will go on perpetually, forever, by doing two things. By simultaneously waging war on ISIS and by supplying ISIS with weapons.
My name's Grant Collins. I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. I was a corporal in the 1st Battalion, 23rd Marines. Was in Iraq from August of 04 to May of 05. A few months after I was there, I mean, a lot of things weren't sitting right with me. The command structure, the missions that we were getting didn't make any sense. We're going after people, Mujahideen or Muj, and they didn't have any idea which ones were the right ones. We're kicking in the wrong doors, terrifying children, helicopters screaming over their heads at night, and I'm trying to calm the women and children while the men were dragged and separated out and completely humiliated in front of their families. In that culture, it's a very big deal to be treated with respect in front of your family, just as it is in ours. But in this, I mean, it can mean a lot of shame. When I really, really, really came to the point where I knew that what we were doing was absolutely morally wrong was when a few days after Bush was reelected, we had already cordoned off Fallujah. And Cloy was in the first incursion in April. Where we took heavy casualties and then decided that maybe it wasn't the right time to go in. Maybe there's too many of them in there. So I was a part of the cordon where we cordoned it off, and then we made operations to move in. And 2 o'clock in the morning, we went across the berm and instantly started taking casualties, but started lighting up the city like you wouldn't believe. Artillery strikes going in and planes flying in and dropping 500-pound JDAM bombs into, obviously, civilian areas. I mean, my platoon was tasked with moving down a certain sector from the north side of the city, come up to a four-story like apartment building, and we had encountered heavy resistance from there, and there was no way that we were going to be able to clear it with using people, so we called an airstrike on it, a helicopter strike with it, and after a couple of them, the building just completely collapsed in. And I was thinking at the time, how many civilians could have been inside there. I mean, just like any kind of conflict, there's people that are hiding inside of places that are unable to come out of these buildings out of fear that they're going to be killed by the enemy or our enemy for leaving, or out of fear that they're going to get shot in the streets, because when they do, they come out and they do get shot in the streets trying to get away. We moved down another block and we came up to a smaller building, and my squad was tasked with taking this building, and the doorway, there was fire coming out of the doorway, machine gun fire, and from the windows. So I gave the order for them to use the missiles on the building. So we hit it, and then we stormed into the building, and about a 14-year-old kid, a 6-year-old kid, and this could have been her husband. I couldn't tell because he was so messed up. And a woman that was bleeding, but not severely. And all she was screaming, why? Laish, Laish. And And I broke down. I leaned up against the wall, and I as my rest of my Marines cleared through the building, and I sat there with the corpsman trying to do something about it. But I started to cry. I wanted to rip my hair out, go nuts. And the woman, seeing my reaction, came up to me and put her hand on my cheek and said, "Inshallah," which is God's will. Because these people over there, it doesn't matter what bad things happen to them, that they can accept it right away as God's will because they're deeply religious. But no, it wasn't God's will. I gave the order to fire those rockets into that building, and I killed her family.
There's over 100 companies that are making a fortune off of our wars. But there's one company in particular that is making money specifically off of the war against ISIS. It's called SOS International. And on the company's board of directors, quoting from the Daily Beast by Kate Brennan, on the board of advisors is former Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, considered to be one of the architects of the invasion of Iraq, and Paul Butler, a former special assistant to Pentagon Chief Donald Rumsfeld. The company, which goes by SOSI, says on its website that the contracts it has been awarded for work in Iraq in 2015 have a total value of more than $400 million. They include a $40 million contract to provide everything from meals to perimeter security to emergency fire medical services at Iraq's Besmaya compound, one of the sites where U.S. troops are training Iraqi soldiers. The Army awarded SOSI a separate $100 million contract in late June for similar services at Camp Taji. The Pentagon expects that contract to last through June of 2018, well into the next presidency. A year after U.S. airstrikes began targeting the so-called Islamic State in Iraq, there are 3,500 U.S. troops deployed there, training and advising Iraqi troops. But a number that is not discussed is the growing number of contracts required to support these operations. According to the U.S. military, there are 6,300 contractors working in Iraq today supporting the U.S. operations. While these numbers can pale in comparison to the 163,000 working in Iraq at the peak of the Iraq war, they are once again steadily growing. And with the fight against ISIS expected to take several years, it also represents a growing opportunity for defense, security, and logistics contractors, especially as work in Afghanistan begins to dry up.
A man came up to me and he handed me his Purple Heart. Now I said to him, is that like the real one or is that a copy? And he said, that's my real Purple Heart. I have such confidence in you. And I said, man, that's like big stuff. I always wanted to get the Purple Heart. This was much easier.
I've had a lot of wars of my own. I'm really good at war. I love war in a certain way.
The National Priorities Project is one of the groups that is tracking the cost of the war. And every hour, according to their website, taxpayers in the United States are paying $8.36 million for total cost of war since 2001. When I printed out this article yesterday, it said that just for the cost of the Pentagon, this doesn't include all the other costs associated with the war, because we are over, I think, $6 trillion now? We can't do anything here at home, but we've got trillions for war. So over at the National Priorities Project at nationalpriorities.org, what you can do is you can plug in your specific city, your specific state, whatever. So I decided to plug in Vancouver, Washington, where I live very near to. And it says, for you in Vancouver, Washington, plug in any city you want. It says, for you in Vancouver, Washington, you are paying $228.73 million, not including the cost of the war. So this is just the Pentagon cost, okay? But we're paying $8.36 million every hour. Here's what your money could have been spent on had the Pentagon not spent it. 2,716 elementary school teachers for a year, or 3,087 clean energy jobs created for a year, or infrastructure jobs created for a year, which these are things that make money when you do them. War doesn't make money. It makes money for someone else, but it doesn't come back to us here in America. 2,287 jobs with supports created in high poverty communities for a year, or over 22,000 Head Start slots for children for a year, or over 23,000 military veterans receiving VA medical care, which they're not getting right now, or over 6,200 scholarships for university students for 4 years, or 9,800 students receiving Pell Grants, of $5,800 for 4 years, or 118,000 children receiving low-income health care for a year, or 224,940 households with wind power for a year, or 65,000 adults receiving low-income health care for a year, or 138,944 households with solar electricity for a year. But instead of those things that benefit us as a society and us as a country, what do we get instead? Because we've decided to not pay attention, because we've decided to not be a part of it, because we've decided to not care, we've gotten nothing and been plenty happy with it.
I went back to my vehicle, and I was about to open up a meal when I heard a gunshot that went over our heads from the right to the left. I immediately stepped from behind my vehicle, and my Marines were already discharging their weapons towards the protesters. I unslung my weapon, and I put the weapon up into my shoulder, and I began to fire. When everything was said and done, we went and did a reconnaissance of the bodies. We were looking for weapons, and I remember looking at the bodies. They were wearing the traditional jaliban, white jaliban, and there it was completely soaked with blood. And I remember I was looking at the bodies, and I'm looking for weapons, and I don't see any weapons. And then I look up, and about 50 meters away from the protesters was some RPGs that were lined up against the wall. And I thought to myself, they had the capability to fire at us if they wanted to, but they didn't. So that means that they were holding a protest, a peaceful protest. And then all of a sudden in your mind, you realize that you just murdered some people. 20 minutes later, a car sped into our checkpoint area. We discharged our weapons and come to find out that it was innocent life again. And then another one happened. And then another one happened. By the last one, I had an occupant of the vehicle asking me, "Why did you kill my brother? We didn't do anything. We're not terrorists." I was so devastated by my commanding officer, Captain Schmidt. He came up to me and he said, "Staff Sergeant," I said, What's wrong? You look a little under the weather." And I said, "Well, today's been a bad day, sir. We've killed a lot of civilians." And he said, "No, today's a good day." When he said that, I realized that I was in the wrong place, that maybe I wasn't cut out for the Marine Corps.
I would love to say that electing Hillary Clinton will begin to bring about an end to these wars, but I can't say that. She has been a war hawk. I would love to say that if Donald Trump became president, it would bring about an end to these wars, but I can't say that because he himself has said into the mic and in front of a camera that he loves war and that we are going to bomb the SH out of ISIL. Now, you might think that it's unfair for me to turn to you or any other one of my fellow Americans and say, the way things have turned out is on you. But here's the thing, America, whether you turned out for the primaries or not, if you did not turn out for the primaries, you could have. And you could have picked a much better candidate, but you didn't. And those of you that did turn out for the primaries picked two people, the two most unlikable people, the two most distrusted people in the entire election. You picked Donald Trump and you picked Hillary Clinton. Melvin, it's not fair of you to say that this is our fault. If you did not turn out in the primaries, this is on you. If you turned out in the primaries and you voted for one of these knuckleheads, it's pretty clear that you don't want change.
My name is Daryl Anderson. I served in Baghdad, Iraq from January 04 to July 04. But I'll start it off with my progression in Iraq. It started with 9/11 because that's what led to the war. Like Dennis was saying, that's what fueled the fire. That's the big part of the lie that led to the lies I witnessed in Iraq. So I didn't join because of 9/11, because to me, growing up as a kid in Kentucky, I was working 50 hours a week. I was selling drugs to pay my child support. I was broke. I was a hood rat. And I was growing up like you probably see a bunch of kids running around the ghettos around here. And 9/11 happened. It didn't affect me. I didn't think about it because I didn't have health care. I was working a job that paid me $5 something an hour. What do I care about these 3,000 people that died when my friends are dying every day in the street? I didn't know it would come to affect me one day. But I also knew about the Desert Storm guys who became terrorists. But all of a sudden in Kentucky, because it was some brown people in Kentucky were looking at me like I was a terrorist. Because I'm dark, I can grow a beard. You know, and I'm not as white as many as you people in the room. I'm white, but I'm not that light. So I started to feel a lot of that, like, man, people are, you know, they're worried about they're going to hit Fort Knox in Kentucky. And I'm thinking, this is racism. This is what feeds the fuel that Iraqis are beneath us, and we can go kill them. Because look it, they killed 3,000 innocent people. They don't care about innocent lives. In Desert Storm, we couldn't get into Baghdad because the people heard about the innocent people we killed in the bombings. Now, 3,000 Americans are dead. We don't care how many Iraqis you got to kill. Killing the civilians is part of war. And that's what they sent us into Baghdad with.
Does that not sound at all familiar? We saw racism there, like we saw racism here. And we tell everyone to be suspicious of your, be suspicious of everyone around you. Be suspicious of those that are different from you. Be suspicious of those whose skin color is not like yours. This from The Intercept, and these sources I'm using right now, The Intercept, Truthout, The Guardian, these are the sources I'm having to go to because American media isn't covering any of this. Now, I know these are good and true sources. I've never been able to find a hole in anything that they've published. But we're not talking about this in America because it seems like nobody cares. The headline, leaked data reveals how the U.S. trains vast numbers of foreign soldiers and police with little oversight at 9:30 a.m. on a gray winter Monday. The State Department officials began certifying the names at a rate of one every 2 minutes and 23 seconds. This is how fast these people are being certified as police officers, soldiers, sailors, airmen. In rapid succession, they confirmed that 204 police officers, soldiers, sailors, and airmen from 11 countries had committed no gross human rights violations and cleared them to attend one of more than 50 training efforts sponsored by the U.S. government. The programs are taking place at a wide variety of locations from Italy, Albania, and Jordan to the states of Louisiana and Minnesota. 32 Egyptians were approved for instruction in, among other things, Apache helicopter gunship maintenance and flight simulators in Sikorsky UH-60 Blackhawks. Azerbaijanis were cleared for a U.S. Army course on identifying biowarfare agents in Maryland and underwater demolition training with Navy SEALs in San Diego. 33 Iraqis were certified to attend a State Department training session for bodyguards held in Jordan. Bosnians who were bound for Macedonia to prepare for deployment to Afghanistan. Ukrainian police were selected for peacekeeping training in Italy. Romanians would study naval operations in Rhode Island and counterterrorism in Skopje. This was only the beginning of 1 day's work of vetting security personnel for U.S. training, a joint investigation by The Intercept and 100 reporters. That's the source, 100 reporters, reveals that the chaotic and largely unknown details of vast constellation of global training exercises, operations, facilities, schools, a shadowy network of U.S. programs that every year provides instruction and assistance to approximately 200,000 foreign police and other personnel. The data show training at no fewer than 471 locations in 120 countries on every continent but Antarctica, involving on the U.S. side 150 defense agencies, civilian agencies, and armed forces, and it goes on. And so these are the folks that we certify in rapid succession, get them on our side, so to speak, and we don't really know a whole lot about them. And this just sets us up for failure. But failure sets us up for more perpetual warfare.
Every single apartment building in Baghdad has been broken to the ground by artillery and airplanes bombing. You cannot meet someone in Iraq who has not lost a family member. Could you imagine what we had done in America if in 9/11 everybody in America lost a family member? What would we be doing? Would we be talking about war? No, we'd be in the streets with weapons. And so people talk about, oh, these people killing American soldiers in Iraq, they're terrorists. Not terrorists, they're wearing sandals. And they got an AK. And they got 14-year-old boys building bombs to kill these American soldiers because we've killed their family.
We're not fighting against an enemy or a perceived enemy. We are creating an enemy through our U.S. foreign policy. And we're spending trillions on it, all the while saying that we cannot spend this money on domestic programs. We cannot take care of our people here. I'm sorry. We're too busy killing people in foreign lands and making contractors rich.
So we're done in Baghdad. We killed enough people. I was ordered to kill innocent people. We killed innocent people. When they shot at us, we shot everybody. We were done, you know. Every guy I served was against the war.
Well, see that, Melvin? I think it's pretty clear what's going on here. It's the government. The government is the problem. Perhaps if we just get rid of government, have we learned nothing? That's what we did in Iraq. We got rid of the government, expected that the free market, the invisible hand of the free market, was just going to take over, make Iraq all better, and it did not make it better. The government has problems. Yes, our government has problems, but it's broken. But we broke it on purpose, and it remains broken thanks to us.
As now, I won't even talk to politicians about the war, because there ain't no point in it. Democrat, Republican, they're all profiteers of war. Even lots of anti-war organizations are profiting off my brother's pain. You know, no Iraq veterans are getting paid off this war. No, we're all just sitting in the street homeless.
And even the current U.S. president, my president, the guy that I voted for twice, who I was hoping would help bring the wars to an end. And we pulled a lot of soldiers out of these countries we are engaging in war in. But what we've decided to do instead, so that we suffer less U.S. casualties, is we've started sending in drones. And now they're bombing hospitals, and now they're bombing schools. There was a big story about a wedding that got bombed a number of years back. And yeah, perhaps we're taking out terrorists, but we're creating a lot more terrorists than we're taking out. And so perhaps we're learning from our experiences, right? Now, this president, the guy I voted for twice, the guy that some of you might have even voted for twice, is now, this according to the District Sentinel, stretches the definition of congressional approval for war. We're stretching the definition of going to war. In court filings last month, Department of Justice lawyers argued that the current war effort against ISIL, known as Operation Inherent Resolve, does not violate the War Powers Act. The 1973 law restricts the president's powers to commit the U.S. military to a sustained armed conflict for more than 60 days without congressional approval. The legislature has yet to formally approve authorization for the use of military force. So in the Congress, they like to talk tough about, we need to go after ISIL, we need to take out ISIL, the president's doing anything about ISIL, but they won't even talk about it in Congress, nor will they approve any sort of action. So the president is going it alone. This despite the fact that the administration has been carrying out regular airstrikes in Iraq and Syria for nearly 2 years. But the DOJ claimed in court the Congress has lent its approval to the conflict in other ways, including through funding the military operations. Quote, the president has determined that he has the authority to take military action against ISIL, the brief states, and Congress has ratified that determination by appropriating billions of dollars in support of the military operation. The White House has also suggested that the 2001 AUMF, which is the authorization for the use of military force against al-Qaeda, also provides the authority needed to fight against ISIL. In a statement made to the New York Times, Senator Tim Kaine rejected the administration's argument. Quote, a decision to fund defense operations is vastly different than a war authorization. Our troops risking their lives deserve to know whether Congress stands with them. Kaine has been a consistent critic of his colleagues for not taking up an ISIL-specific war authorization. And this was one of the interesting things to me about Hillary Clinton picking him. Because, yeah, he has been very outspoken against the wars.
Today marks the completion of 9 months of America's war against ISIL. Tomorrow, May 8, starts the 10th month of this war. Here's what hasn't happened, Mr. President. Congress, the Article I branch, whose most solemn power is the duty to declare war, has not done its job, has not debated this war, has not taken any formal step to authorize what was started unilaterally by the president 9 months ago. How strange it is, we're in a Congress that loves to punch this president as an imperial president, threaten lawsuits against him when he does stuff without congressional approval. In the most solemn responsibility under Article 1 that Congress has, we have been silent.
Rosa Brooks, who's a professor, recently came out with a book called How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon. And she was on MSNBC recently, and she talked about how not only does the Pentagon not have to ask for money, they sometimes have to say, please stop giving us money. We don't need any more money.
Every year, the Secretary of Defense would write what was called the heartburn letter. And it was a letter after the Defense Department submitted its budget to Congress. He would write a letter, and Congress marked it up and sent it back saying, here's what I don't like about what you want to do to our budget request. And I assumed, of course, that Pentagon would ask for, you know, X amount of money. Congress would say you can have X minus 10%, and that letter would be saying, well, give us back that money we want.
We need more.
But
we need
more.
But
in fact, it was the opposite. I think in the first year, in 2009 or 10, in his letter, there were 14 or 15 items he wanted to argue about Congress with, and 11 of them were, we said we don't want that money, but you're making us take it. Stop it. We don't want that weapon system. We don't want that stuff. This is a stupid idea. Give us less money. Give the State Department more. But didn't have any impact whatsoever, and that's because nobody has a little factory in their constituency full of, you know, manufacturing foreign service employees, right. But lots of people have nice little factories manufacturing weapons.
Yeah.
In a supposed Christian nation where we are supposed to be taking care of our poor, where we are supposed to be feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, where we are supposed to have infrastructure, safe roads that we can drive on, police, where we have jobs that pay us a good amount of money so that we can live a good middle-class life, in a country where we are supposed to be taking care of each other, we're being told all the time, get over it! America doesn't have the money. But I think we've busted that myth this hour. America has the money. We have the money to pay for all these things. We have the money to pay for Head Start. We have the money to pay for our kids to go to college and to go to good schools. We have the money to put them through college. We have the money to pay for people to have universal health care. We have the money to fix our roads and bridges. We have the police. We have the money to pay our police more. We have the money to pay our teachers more. But we have decided that the best thing to do is to spend that money in insane ways, by blowing up countries and by killing innocent people. Not because it's a good idea, but so that American companies who are already rich can get even richer.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
And those companies who are spilling our blood and spending our money and getting rich off killing us and getting rich off killing people in faraway lands, those companies, those American companies, would very, very much like another tax break, please. The audacity is absolutely amazing. But Melvin, what can I do? Would not voting help? No. Would not paying attention help? No. Would just sticking my thumbs in my eyes help? No. Sticking my thumbs in my ears, maybe only paying attention to sports radio, would that help? No. And I think you know the answers to all these questions. We have it within our grasp. And I know that this information is not fun to absorb. It's not fun to think about. It's not at all sexy. This isn't a reality show. This is simply reality. And it's not going to get better until we start getting involved. And we start saying, no, the government is not the problem. The people that we have been hiring to government are the problem. No, we are not broke. It's just the way that we've chosen to spend money is incredibly stupid. And it's stupid because that's the way we like it. But it's not. It's not the way we like it. And it's not the way that it has to be. You have the power to change all this. But you can't do it alone. Just like I can't do it alone. And it might get worse before it gets better, but it will get better. America is building an empire, and empires don't last forever. They fall, they crumble, and they're messy, and that doesn't have to happen. But it will happen if we continue to turn a blind eye and we don't get involved. Whether you sit out the election or whether you vote for the warmonger, it's essentially the same thing. Get involved. Start voting for politicians that are going to see that your interests are at least considered, if not fulfilled. That your money, and yes, you have to think of it in those terms, it's your money. Your money is being spent slaughtering people around the world, and you don't get to throw your hands up and say, nope, I didn't know that was happening. It's your money. When it leaves your hands, you should be tracking what it does, because what it's doing is embarrassing, and it doesn't have to be this way. We've let it get out of hand, but we still have a chance to change it. That begins today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. You can, our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Also, Kiwi Station still has an app and they still carry our show. Thank you, Kiwi. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep a dialogue with our growing listener base, so feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. You've got work to do, and now that I have woken you up, good morning.